starting, we're going to start around 1600. And the real reason, the real honest reason why, is because that's where I got to last year. Last year we started around the year 1000.
Sorry,
yeah, Jewish history. Last year we got to around the year 1000. We started from 1000 and got to around 1600. We got like right through, you know, the Beisos, you know, the Blessed Karo, the Rama, Maharshal, Arizal, Rukhan Vital. We got through that whole, we got up to around 1600. So we're going to start back and go on. I'm not yet sure how far we're going to get. I really will definitely get through the first part of Chassidus, which means to around 1800. I really hope to get to 1850, but I'm not mamish promising. In theory, we could get farther than that, but I really doubt it. I really personally doubt it. There's just a lot of material. And of course, you can't talk about everything, but we'll do as much as we can. Okay, so we're like, this year we're like, you know, much more in the middle of things, starting really in the middle than we did last year. And that's going to cause a problem of context and out of context. You know, we got around 1600 last year, and up until 1600, everything is pretty traditional, per se. It's the beginnings of non-Orthodox Jewry as a significant part of Jewish history when we start. They really start post-Inquisition. And we're going to speak about that. I'll speak about that probably either next week or the week after. That's like the beginnings of non-Orthodox Jewry. Throughout this period, is an issue. It's not as much, you know, in the modern era, the actual modern era, which means post-1800, post-1830, depending on where you want to cut things, then there's a significant stream of non-Orthodox Jews around. And that causes, I don't know, problems. I don't know how you use a lot of different ways to look at it. But complications, I think, is a better word for us to use here. It causes really complications. Now, still the facts are that if you want to properly understand something, you have to see it as a whole. I mean, we're in what I call postmodern times. Maybe we're even hypermodern today. You know, and I'm not going to speak at length to explain exactly what that means. That has real meaning. So I'm not just like, you know, like throwing something out. That has real meaning. And it's like, I don't know. I don't think anyone personally relates to the Civil War as a real thing. Oh, yeah, Silver Spring. I doubt your parents born in Silver Spring.
I'm from Virginia. So.
Virginia. Oh, better. Oh, amazing. You grew up in Virginia.
Yeah.
Richmond.
My life. No, Fairfax.
Fairfax. Okay.
Right near everything.
Right near everything. Okay. Because we have a southerner here.
What?
So we have a southerner here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, okay. In the South, they take the Civil War very seriously. I mean, very seriously.
They do.
I mean, like, really seriously. It's a good question. I don't want to get bogged down. That's an interesting question. But certainly, if you go back farther, to take something like the 30 Years of War seriously in a personal fashion. I mean, everyone's American here, so it's the Revolutionary War. Anyone takes the Revolutionary War seriously? What?
Canadian.
Canadian? Canadians are interesting people.
What's your take on Canadians?
I'll tell you something. Canadians are very touchy when they're accused of being American.
It's true.
However, non-Canadians,
Canada.
Europeans and Israelis consider Canadians for all practical purposes Americans. Canadian history is utterly boring.
Tax drivers treat us just the same way.
To be fair, I was in Canada this summer, and we got broke. Like we broke down there, and let me just say, Canadians are way nicer than Americans.
That's true.
I mean, by
if I must say so myself.
Okay. Anyway, Vinyanenu, let's get back to our point. The point is we have the later we go back in history, the harder it is for us to relate to it in a real fashion. And that relates to us in this case, and what we're talking about is the total picture of Jewish history. Jewish history is big. Jewish history is very large. It's very large. Jewish history is 3,200 years old, or maybe even older, depending on when you want to start from Lamed Har Sinai, if we want to start from the Exodus, if we want to go back to the forefathers of the Avos, it's close to 4,000 years old. That's massive. That's like big. The only other nation which comes close are the Chinese. So why is it really important to realize that? Because as the Zohar says, Yisrael Baraisa Kucha Bricha Chadu, Jewish people, Torah, and Kucha Brichu, and the Holy One, blessed be He, and Hashem and God, are all one thing. And that has a certain meaning, that to a large extent, the Jewish people are a certain facet of Torah. Is there a chumash here with Rashi? Chumash with Rashi? No, I need a chumash with Rashi. Okay, no, we don't have to. No, it's fine. Okay. Let me give you an example, just to illustrate something. Everyone's familiar with. There's a very famous Jewish joke about the Jewish Robinson Crusoe. Two on a desert island for 23 years.
Okay,
he builds one of everything, but except for two shuls. They come and pick him up. One city hall, one store, one this, one that, one the next two shuls. Two shuls. So I dive in here, and I don't go into that one. So that's like the one of the jokes which illustrates how Jews are opinionated. Jews are very opinionated. But if you think that it's a new phenomenon, you're wrong. Pasuk says, Moshe turns to Hashem and says to him, in the middle of Parshas Pinchas, he says, Hashem al keruchos avabasar. He says, Yivkar Hashem al keruchos avabasar isha la'edah. Hashem, who's Elokei, the God of all spirits, should appoint someone over everybody. The term Elokei ruchos avabasar for Hashem is almost unique. It's only used one other place in Tanakh, as far as I know. Two places. It's a very unique term. Why is it used? So Rashi says, this Moshe Rabbeinu is davening, he is praying, he's asking Hashem to appoint a new leader. And he said to Hashem, Hashem, you know that everyone's opinion is, every Jew has a different opinion? Nele Manik, appoint a leader? Who knows how to disciple, who knows how to deal, who knows how to handle each one according to their opinion. So we shouldn't think that Jews being opinionated is wrong. We shouldn't think it's an anomaly of Jewish history. That's the rule of Jewish history. Jews are opinionated, very opinionated, for as long as we know. And they're always going to be. So that's the reason why, even though we're starting at the end, it's important to realize that the end connects back to the beginning. Even when we're talking about secular Jews who grow up without knowing anything, there's still, to a certain extent, where Benny spoke about this Thursday night, every Jew has a pentel yid, every Jew has a Jewish neshama, has a Jewish soul, and that soul has in it a certain reflection of Torah, certain reflection and facets of Torah. So, it's important. This is an important point for us to remember here. Okay, now there's a very classic question that people talk about, and they talk about Jewish. They talk about history at large, and I feel I want to speak about it also. And it is Jewish history.
Where's Kiruv training?
I have no idea. That's Rabbi Olshan.
Computer.
And everyone wants to know, why should we study history? Why is that answer? So, the classic answer is?
We have to study history, so sure, we shouldn't repeat it.
It's written on archives.
It's written on the archives. If you go into Auschwitz, you see it all over the place. On every single floor in the museum in Auschwitz, it says, he who doesn't study the mistakes of history is doomed to repeat them, more or less. I need to take a picture of that sign, so I don't remember exactly what this is. Well, so it says.
It's to give history teachers jobs.
It's to give history teachers jobs. Yeah, no, okay, I don't, maybe not. Maybe not. Okay. Now, I will historically disprove this. No, not what you said. What you said, there's certain truth to it. There's certain truth to it, but I don't think that's what I don't know. Okay. We've all, of course, heard of Winston Churchill, right? You heard of Churchill? The famous Winston Churchill. Okay. He was a tremendous historian, as I hope we're aware. We all know that? No? We're aware of that?
One of his famous lines,
one of his famous lines, yes.
Can I say what period of history is
it? We're starting in around 1600.
Really? How come?
Because that's where I got to last year. It's going to be fun.
1600, like,
BC? Yeah, it's 1600 CE. 400 years ago. 400 years ago. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to do Shaptite speed. That's going to be hard and fun.
Oh, I'm definitely interested.
Last year, we showed them.
Why not older, like, nubby stuff?
Nubby stuff, that's that. First of all, I have a nubby Seder at night. Second of all, there's a, supposedly they claim there's a Nachmikius program between 9 and 9:15 in the morning. I don't know if it's true, but it's like rumors via the grapevine.
Yeah, it's, if whoever wants to, cut short and go.
That's our section.
What? No, you do it on your own. You do it with Chavrusa, you could ask the Rebbe and he'll set you up with someone.
Okay, so Churchill was a well-known historian. One of his famous lines, he lost the election right after the Second World War. And one of his famous lines was, he says, the opposing, you know, the other party, in other words, the ruling party.
Of course, he was drunk while he said, probably.
No, he wasn't drunk. He liked to pretend he was drunk. He usually wasn't drunk. Okay. He said the party in power should leave the war to history. Especially as I plan to be writing most of that history. So that's one of Churchill's lines. But he wrote a number of historical works, well known as a historian, and certainly an astute student of history. Now I'll give you two examples. In Churchill's first book about the Second World War, he's talking about what it should be called. And of course, we call it the Second World War. But he says, if you would ask him, he'd say it should be called the Unnecessary War, because there were so many times you could have stopped Hitler. There were so many times, over and over and over, he could have easily been stopped many times.
Looking back at it,
not just looking back at it, they were close. They were close a number of times. The closest, okay. Practically speaking, in other words, there's certain what ifs, like Hitler remilitarizes the Rhineland in 1936. He had an untrained army of 180,000 men.
Going to Russia.
The French, what?
When he went into Russia, he turned them back around or something like that?
When he went to where?
When he was on the Russian front.
No, not that. 1936, when he remilitarized the Rhineland. Okay? The French, right. he had no tanks, no planes, nothing. The French had, without mobilizing anyone, an army of, I'm going to throw this out of my head, at least 600,000. All they had to do was march. And the German general said, if they would have marched, we would have turned around and left, because there was no way in the world. We didn't have machine guns. We didn't have anything.
They didn't anticipate what you would do.
I can explain why they did it, but that's not for now. But that's what I call a what if, which was there were the French didn't even think of doing it, so it doesn't make any much of a difference. The real what if of the Second World War was when Churchill in 1936, a little after that, really had roused Britain and was about to change the government and change governmental policy about rearmament. He was there. Everything was falling into place. It's long, complicated maneuvers how he got the government into a position. He was out of the government. He got the government in a position where he was ready to either pull the government down or become one of the most important ministers in the government and completely change English policy, and that would have definitely changed history. What happened? King Edward VIII decided he wanted to marry an American divorcee. And Churchill had a romantic attachment to the English monarchy, and he temporarily lost control of his judgment. He felt the king should be allowed to do what he wants, which the English people didn't agree with. And as a result of that, he made himself look like a fool. And he has a long, complicated history. He had been involved in English politics since 1900. And as a result of that, even though he was literally one step away from changing history, and he would have changed it immensely, immensely. You know, the Yad Hashem came in and knocked him off. There's nothing you can do about it. 1944, that's one example. He knew history, he understood history, he understood the lessons from history, he understood Hitlerism threat, it didn't help. 1944, Churchill's sitting in one of the synagogues of America, I don't know, on a plane, I don't know where, or Stam, I don't know, with his doctor, turns to his doctor, and he says, I'm not going to make the mistake that Cromwell made. His doctor was like, yes, sir, Prime Minister, what do you mean? Well, so Cromwell was obsessed with the Spanish. And he didn't realize that the Spanish were no longer going to be a threat to Europe. Cromwell's in the mid-1600s. Spanish were no longer really a threat. The real threat was France. And I'm not going to make that mistake. In other words, I'm not going to make Cromwell's mistake. I know that Germany's going to be done with when the war's over. And the real threat's Russia. What was the problem? The problem was is the masses of the Americans and English were not able to go on with that policy. They felt that the Russians were so great for doing what they did, for defeating the Germans, and the Russians were the primary reason why the Allies won the Second World War. It's the Russians. There was no way for him to implement that policy. So I'm just showing you that you can know history, you can understand the lessons of history, still not necessarily going to help you. And now to go on, one last example is Shimon Peres. Now I'm personally, Shimon Peres is sort of like a Chassidus Rebbe. I don't know how you guys follow Israeli politics.
Yeah, a little bit.
You know Shimon Peres is?
Peres.
President of the State of Israel?
No,
Shimon Peres? Okay. Shimon Peres has been involved in Israeli politics for almost 60 years.
Wait, is he still?
He was Prime Minister. He is the president.
Okay,
president.
Yes,
he's Nasi Hamadina.
Yeah.
He's the president of the state. Correct? You know Shimon Peres?
Yeah.
He's been involved in Israeli politics on a high level since the early 50s. And now, I call him Chassidus Rebbe. And what do I mean is Chassidus Rebbe? Chassidus Rebbe have Chassidim and Misnagdim. They have people who love them and people who hate them. Menachem Begin was also Chassidus Rebbe. Even more than Shimon Peres. Menachem Begin, unbelievable Chassidus Rebbe. I don't quite grasp him. A very, very fascinating figure who had, again, he has people who loved him and people who mamish hate him. Now, I'm personally not one of the Hasidim of Shimon Peres. I mean, he's convinced that he knows how to bring peace to the Middle East, and I'm convinced that he's wrong. However, he has a lot of high-level experience in government. And I'm going to give you the following quote, which I think I could pull out of my computer somewhere, because I thought it was so important I saved it. He said, you know, you can be involved in policy making, and under the circumstances, things are very clear. But in certain times of crisis, all of a sudden, suddenly, things get very cloudy and unclear. And after the crisis is over, you look back and you say, how did I make such a stupid mistake? That's how it works, you know. That's how practical policy works.
What causes the mistake?
I don't remember when he said it. I'd have to look and see if I can find the quote on my computer.
In your opinion, why would you not use continue?
Why is this true? Why is this true? Because as we say, Rabos Machshavos Mlevish, Batzis Hashem Yisakim. At the end of the day, there's a certain dichotomy between Bechira, between man's free will, and Atzis Hashem, and what Hashem wants to have. There's a certain dichotomy, a certain, you know, tension and conflict between the two. And as the Rambam says in the Hilchos Deis, Hilchos Tshuva, as the Rambam says in Hilchos Tshuva, they're both true. We know that man has free will, and we know that Hashem knows what's going on and is in charge of it. And in these historical cases, that's when we can see it. There's certain things you can't do, even though there is Bechira. There's a certain limit to Bechira. Okay, fine. So why should we study history?
What? This is a famous question, but how do we have free will? If God knows what's going to happen,
I'm sorry. I'm not. That's a, as the Rambam says, it's a very difficult topic. That's a very difficult topic, and I personally don't want to speak on it without properly preparing it. I don't. It's a difficult topic. It takes to do it properly. It needs preparation, and I don't believe in what's called in Yiddish varfing, which means spewing ideas out without thinking them through.
Varfing.
Varfing. Yeah. That's what's called in Yiddish. In English, they call it shooting from the cuff, but in Yiddish, it's called varfing. It's like sort of also can mean like throwing up.
Yeah, varfing.
It's similar. You're right. There's a certain similarity to the meaning. Okay. Now, so that now we get back to Rokas. So what are we studying history for? What are we studying history for? So I'm going to give a couple of reasons why I think we should study history. I'm not convinced we can know history quite well. I'm not convinced we're going to, at the time of crisis, be able to make the right decision. Either people won't listen to the person who has the right decision, or the person who could make the right decision will have their mind clouded if, for whatever reasons, that is what is going needs to happen. Say again?
If the king wants to get to marry to the divorce.
That's right. You never know what's going to happen. So why should we study history? So, there's a couple of reasons to study history. One is, and this is not, in this class, we're not going to see it that much, but one is we could see Yad Hashem, we could see Hashgacha Pratis, we could see how Hashem runs the world. And that we could definitely see. There's a definite fragility to human history. Who, again, you know, that example, the example of Churchill and King Edward VIII is a classic example. Another one, which you may be more familiar with, is, you know, the July 20th, 1944 plot to assassinate Hitler, which should have worked. It didn't work because he had a meeting, in a hut above ground, as opposed to underground. The bomb was pushed away. The guy pushed away didn't mean to push it away. The bomb was put right next to Hitler. Oh, I'm not actually sure if it would have blown up next to Hitler or would have killed him. Yeah, there was a Valkyrie. Okay.
Yeah, I didn't like how they made Valkyrie.
I don't know. I did not see the movie. I know it historically. I'll tell you something. My father worked for NASA for a long time, and he didn't bother going to see the movie Apollo 13. But then so many people drove him crazy about it. He said, "Okay, I'll go see the movie. Be mad at me. I'll go see the movie." So he said, "The movie. The only thing that's true is they took off. They took off. They had a full fuel cell failure, and they had to orbit the moon to get back. That was all true. The portrayals of all the individuals there was all not true."
There's actually a new one for that.
That could be. I don't know if it's going to be any better. I mean, you understand, the point of making a movie is to make money. It's not to give accurate historical portrayal of
events. Even in real history, a lot of people trying to make Valkyrie into this whole entire hero, the people that tried to assassinate Hitler, even though they were actually Nazis, I mean...
Okay. Of course, you're not wrong. You're not totally off. They weren't the world's greatest tzaddikim, but it's a good question. Whatever. That's interesting. I don't want to diverge too much. It's an interesting question if they would have actually, actively stopped the Holocaust at that point or not. That's a very interesting question, and that's an interesting question. I want to go on, and we'll maybe come back to the point. Okay. Now another reason is connection. And what do I mean by connection? That is one of the deepest and fundamental problems we face today is as we're living in the postmodern world or hypermodern world, we don't really feel connected to the old world. We don't take events past a certain amount of time ago as real. We don't view them as real. I mean, if a person doesn't have a website, he's not really real, is he? But if he's not on Facebook, he can't find his, Facebook.
Is that an issue, or is that just us living in the present?
One second.
Is that an issue that we don't remember the past, or is that just us living in the present? They were doing the same thing.
Yes or no? Look. I'll tell you a story. A long time ago, not that long ago, about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, I was eating a meal with an older Hungarian Czechoslovakian woman. Transylvania. Anyone's grandparents from Transylvania?
Great grandparents? I have some ancestor that's from Transylvania.
Okay, Transylvania.
Explain the birthday.
Count Dracula was quite proud. Transylvania could either have been part of Czechoslovakia, Hungary, or Romania, depending on the year. And of course, everyone from Czechoslovakia is near the border, because the entire breadth of the country, you know, it's a long, thin country. You can't be more than 70 miles away from the border. That's not possible. The whole country is not 150 miles from north to south. You're always somewhere close to the border. Border's changing, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, she was from Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, depending on the year. So somehow or another, I mentioned Chmielnytskyi. I don't remember why I mentioned Chmielnytskyi. Chmielnytskyi? Bogdan Chmielnytskyi was the leader of the Cossack Rebellion in 1648-1649. That's who he was. Historically, good question, exactly how many Jews he killed. Because it's pre-modern history, no one really knows. No, it's no way to prove it. It's similar to German popular history about the 30 Years' War. Jewish popular history says that Bogdan Chmielnytskyi killed over half, or two-thirds, or three-quarters of the Jews in Ukraine and Poland. Contemporary historians don't think that's true. But that's not really important. But it's definitely important that he definitely killed a lot of Jews, and he was definitely considered by Jews a really, a real bad guy, you know, one of the villains of history. A villain of Jewish history. Bogdan Chmielnytskyi. Now, I know she wasn't really a Holocaust survivor. Sort of a Holocaust survivor, not really a Holocaust survivor. I wouldn't mention Hitler within her presence, because that's sensitive topic. Then Chmielnytskyi, I figured Chmielnytskyi. She starts cursing Chmielnytskyi, like seriously, like rapidly, like that. this is why. So I said to her, how long ago do you think Chmielnytskyi lived? This is around 1992 or so, okay? She says, about 100 years ago. Okay, so maybe she's thinking from when she was a kid 100 years ago. I said, no. Almost 350 years ago. She says, are you sure about that? I said, yes, I'm 100% sure about that. I can't believe that. But see, those are people who are connected to history. They shouldn't view Bogdan Chmielnytskyi as a historical character. I have to learn about him. I have to think about him. Should I feel something? You want me to be honest? I don't feel any real emotions about Bogdan Chmielnytskyi. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not going to lie and tell you I do. But I don't feel any, I don't have any honest emotion about him.
So you're not connected?
We're not connected.
It's too far in history.
It's 350 years ago. I mean, I have a certain intellectual, I have a definite intellectual dislike of him. I definitely do. I'm not going to tell you I don't. But I don't have a deep emotional connection to say.
it's not like Hitler's emotional.
You're right. I mean, look.
Our grandparents were involved.
You're right. But this is a classic example of what I mean, connection and lack of connection. That's one of the reasons we need to study history. We need to study history in order that we can connect as best as we can to the body of Jewish history. Because that is important for us in a lot, in many ways. In practical ways and in many, a lot of ways. Okay. Now, the other reason is there is a certain amount of learning, of course, we could do from the great people through history, the things we can learn. Certainly, in terms of theoretically formulating policy in the times where we're not trying to go against Yad Hashem, certainly we should use history as a guide as best as we can to figure out what to do, learn lessons, learn who the great people are, learn what we could learn from them. We're going to, over here, here and there. Not, I think last time we did a little more. When we get a little later, we'll do also a little more. There are, of course, the great historical figures are people who we should learn from. We should learn positive things from the great historical figures that we could implement in our lives in a practical way. So that is another reason to study history. But, that's the study of history. So now let's go on and talk about the next topic. The next topic is, what is study of history? Trying to study history. What is history? What is the study of history? Now, historians, psychologists, psychiatrists, sociologists, all like to claim that they are studying a branch of science. That's what they like to claim. Let's see. Anyone's father a doctor here? Doctor? One, just one doctor?
I'm a dentist.
Dentists and doctors, that's pretty solid. But dentists is more solid science than regular medicine.
Yeah, Joseph's father is a doctor.
Okay. Engineers, we don't have any fathers. Engineer. Your father's a doctor and an engineer?
He's a bioengineer.
He's a bioengineer. Oh.
PhD in bioengineering and
Architect.
And my
architect is close. Okay.
And my mother's an engineer as well.
Ooh, wow. Okay, now engineers are convinced, real engineers are convinced, that they're the only people doing the real things out there. See, right? Medicine's like, and psychology's like, pseudoscience. Now, my father's an engineer, and I grew up with this. It's like, my blood sort of, even though I'm not a natural engineer at all. I mean, I could do the hard work I could have done, but it's not inside of me.
You remember my brother Yoni? I don't
know. No, not really.
Are you here?
I've been here for, this is my 6th year here, probably.
Okay, really tall guy? Was
2 years ago?
2 years ago? He was my brother?
I didn't have for me.
Okay, whatever. He's going to be an engineer. Big surprise.
Okay, whatever. That's a different career choice is a different issue. You know, when there's a problem that when you're young, when you're 17, 18, 19 years old, you have to make career choices, and you don't really, I don't mean to offend or insult anyone, you don't know yourself yet. So it could be, hopefully you make the right decision, but usually engineering is hard to make the right, usually engineers are like, that's a pretty obvious thing. Anyway, so, is history science? Now, my father was asked many times when I was young, how can you be a scientist and also be religious? So his standard, I'll give you a standard answer, which I think is an important answer. So he just say, Max, what's science?
Rhetorical?
What is science? It's not rhetorical. What is science? How do we define what science is?
Study of life.
Study of life, no.
Conclusion by induction.
That's step two. Step one. Step one. Okay, my father holds that Bra. What were the two early Copernicus, Bra, and who was the other?
Galileo.
Maybe Galileo. I can't remember who else. There's another one.
Geocentric.
Kepler. Kepler. Galileo. Copernicus. He holds they are the great scientists. Why is he holding why? Because he always says, he said this for like as long as I can remember, science is the collection and analysis of data. You have to have a good body of data before you can start analyzing and figuring out, is there a pattern? If you have 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, 100, I'm not sure that's a pattern yet. I want to see a real pattern. Tycho Brahe spent decades observing planetary motion. Decades! And then he said, okay, let's see if we can figure something out. And I told him like Ma'indin, when there's a major halachic issue is there is a slight difference in Shkia between if you have a mountain here and bottom of a mountain here. Now, the difference between sunset from here and here, depending on how high the mountain is, it could vary between, let's say, 3 to 7 minutes.
So there's a difference.
I don't want to get into halachically. It's a good question, and I don't want to get into it afterwards. And I say over dinner, I'll explain the whole sugya to you if you want. But I told him that Rabbi Yosef Schwartz, an early one of the early Chachmei Yerushalayim from 150 years ago, made a couple of thousand. I don't remember if it's 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 observations between the old city and the top of Har Zeisim. And said there's a 4-minute difference. There's 2,000, 3,000. Tell us to my father, said, that's a real scientist. 2,000, 3,000 observations, that proves something. In other words, because just scientific theory. And he worked in NASA in in the heroic era in the 60s. And there was a lot of there was Newtonian physics that said X things should happen. And similarly, there's Einstein's theory of until he says X should happen. When they actually blow up atomic bombs, it doesn't quite happen. Something else slightly different happens. So then you have to figure out why that's going on. I mean, I'm not sure if we made enough atomic explosions really to have a large enough body to figure out what's going on. They shot up a lot of rockets. A lot. Most of them you didn't even hear about. Okay, it's supposed to do this, it did something slightly different. Why? Okay, that's science. We see, we have, we take a large body of data, and we analyze it. Now, when it comes to history, we have a big problem because we have to gather our body of data. And contrary to common belief, it's not always so simple to gather. I mean, some facts are pretty simple. Yeah, certain facts are very simple. But once you get past the bare simple, it gets complicated. And it's not always clear, it's not always absolutely clear what really happened. Now, of course, when you read a high school textbook, they don't tell you this. They don't tell you that it said this, but that's not what really happened. I'll give you an example, you know. When you take Europeans, I don't know, you know, I actually don't know what you guys take anymore in high school. But once upon a time in high school, I know in Israel, they still in Bakrut and, you know, Kilo high school diploma, it's a little more than that, really. You have to understand European history. So they tell you there's a triple alliance and a triple entente. You ever heard about that? The triple alliance and the triple entente is a historical fiction. Never existed. I mean, okay, there's a reason why they're making that oversimplification. But there was no such thing as the triple entente. It didn't exist. Britain, England, was not legally obligated to declare war by any document that they signed. And they were very careful to tell everyone who they signed their entente. Entente means understanding. They were very careful they signed it with the French. The French were very nervous to sign it with the English. Because the French had to give up certain, whatever, I don't want to get into all the historical details. They gave things up to get the English to sign this piece of paper. The paper was not an alliance. It was not, when the French and the Russians signed a military alliance, it said the French will put, I'm just guessing right now, 500,000 soldiers on the line over here, and the Russians will put 1 million over here. And that's what it said. If the Germans attack us, if the Germans attack the French, the Russians will attack the Germans. If the Germans attack the Russians, the French will attack the Germans. That's a very simple, straightforward military alliance. Okay? That's not what the English signed at all. They did not sign that. Okay, they said, listen, don't worry. Don't worry, trust us. If you go to war, we will probably help you. And they did. It's kind of, I don't want to get into all those complications. They did. There was, I wouldn't say there was no possibilities. It was relatively unlikely that at that point the English would not have gone to war. But they were not obligated to go to war. I'm just bringing this as an example of the oversimplification that exists when you are, you know, when history is taught at a lower level. And also as an example of the problem of determining fact. Now, there are radical historians. There are radical historians who, if they don't have a first-hand contemporary witness, primary observer, they say, okay, it's not worth anything. If someone who has no way to know writes down whatever the historical fact is, there are some radical historians who will say, who will discount what the person wrote completely, out of hand. They'll say, there's no way you could have known it. And as far as I'm concerned, it has no historical importance. And those are real radicals. Now, of course, parenthetically, from a historical point of view, the great era of history is the Victorian Edwardian era from 1840 to around 1940. Because not only do we have modern archival, you know, we have everything governmental was written down. Every single person kept a diary. Their wife kept a diary. Their friends kept diaries. Asquith, we've ever heard of Asquith? No? Strike, I struck you guys on Asquith. Asquith was Prime Minister at the beginning of the First World War in England. And we know, not only do we have his diary, the notes he wrote during the cabinet meetings, we also have the letters he wrote his mistress in the middle of the cabinet meetings explaining why he was arguing with so-and-so and so-and-so. He went home, his wife was political, he went home, discussed politics with her, and she wrote down what she thought also. So we have like an overly full picture of what he was thinking and why he made his decisions. Similar to Lloyd George, we've heard of Lloyd George? No? Okay, similar things going with Lloyd George also. There's his diary, there's the things he wrote, etc., 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 etc. So that's like, you know, modern history, we have a pretty good idea what really happened. A lot of information, maybe even too much information. Now, when we get to Jewish history, even in the periods we're talking about, so, you know, the prime periods we're talking about from 1600 till 1850, We're lacking a certain amount of first-hand contemporary evidence. We are. And anyone, not so much, you know, Shabtai Tzvi, you'll see in Shabtai Tzvi there's a decent amount of evidence, but it's everything was written afterwards, and people like sort of edited and changed their minds. It was like an embarrassing situation, and everyone didn't like honestly write down what happened afterwards. So, whatever. Okay, so that's going to be a major problem. That's going to be a problem that we have to deal with, and we're going to deal with. Now, there's another similar, parallel issue, which is, you know, certain people have what I call good press agents. They have somebody who's what?
Like things just didn't go public?
No, the person has. You can have a person who is historically important and almost nothing's known about. On the other hand, you can have a person who's not that historically important and he tried to make himself historically important. And the greatest example of that is Amerigo Vespucci. You've heard of Amerigo Vespucci?
Some reason why it's North and South America.
The continents of America are named after him. Do you know what he really was?
He was looking for gold, right?
No, he was not looking for gold. Do you know what he claimed to be?
Explorer.
What?
An explorer.
He claimed to be an explorer. One of the first explorers. However, because we have Spanish records from that era, we can see that he was not first, second, third. He was not no command post of Spain. However, what he did do, he was a great journalist, and he wrote. He was the first person after Columbus to write real lengthy descriptions of what he saw. And he did claim there to have been an excellent navigator, etc., etc., etc. He was such a good press agent that he managed to get himself a job afterwards of being in charge of, interviewing people who wanted to go to the Indies, who wanted to go to America. But Amerigo Vespucci is like an exaggerated example of a person who historically really didn't do that much. He wrote, in a certain sense, sociological sense, interesting reports about the South American Indians, but he didn't really do that much. He did not command any ships. He could not have navigated from the Old World to the New World,
He was smart enough to come up with an idea that would put him in history.
Oh, okay, he's recorded. You're right. He's recorded. Right. No. He's recorded in history. We know, and people know his name. But he didn't really. He did not.
People know his name. He's created the greatest countries in the world.
Well, he didn't create them. His name got tacked onto those countries, and it's not even clear if his press reports got more Spanish. Maybe they didn't. But it's not clear that his press reports got Spanish to go to the quotes Americas. They were going there because of the gold coming back. That's what they're really going there for. Okay. Anyway, now we have an additional challenge. We have an additional challenge, which is, again, so we have our theoretical contemporary observers, or, again, we're more broad-minded than that, and we're not going to limit ourselves to the contemporary observers. We're going to take into account folk history, popular history, people who were afterwards. We can take that into account. Of course, we have to understand that. You have to keep an open mind about it, how much validity it's going to have. We'll keep an open mind. However, we have another very big problem, and we're going to end off with this big problem. This problem is we're studying Jewish history. And I'm going to tell you now, everyone, Jews are opinionated. And everyone is opinionated about Jews. Everyone. There's no such thing as a person who is not highly opinionated about Jews. It doesn't exist.
For those that don't know what a Jew is.
Oh, yeah, once they learn, it does not take them long. Once they learn who Jews are, they get very opinionated, trust me. You know who the most opinionated people about Jews are?
Jews
are so opinionated about Jews. Now I'm going to give you a cute, now we're getting back to the Holocaust, I'll give you some Holocaust examples. Anyone's into Holocaust history? Yes? No? No? Somewhat? You ever read the book Neighbors? No? Hitler's Willing Executioners?
I've read too many books, but I like it. It's interesting.
You read Hitler's Willing Executioners?
Oh, no.
No, okay. Hitler, okay. These are books.
Keep going down the list.
Okay. No, I just picked the two, which each caused massive, the explosion, intellectual explosions these books caused, like, unbelievable. Like, people are, the book Neighbors is a book about a city in northeastern Poland called Jadebna that when the Germans came in, took it over. The Germans did not need to kill the Jews there. The Poles did it for them in an extremely brutal way. Okay, written down, a book that was written about 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago, and there is such unbelievable mass debate about this book, backs and forths, and people, and of course, you know, of course the Poles are insulted, fine, but this, that, unbelievable. Now, Hitler's willing executioners is probably more controversial, probable. It's written by a fellow by the name of Goldhagen, in which he says that the Germans were culturally ready to do the Holocaust and could have done it without Hitler. Now, that's like a very brief synopsis of the book. Also, unbelievable. And almost any Holocaust...
Holocaust as in exterminate the Jews, yes. Or Holocaust as in taking the world war?
Holocaust is in terms of exterminate Jews. He says he holds the Hitler... I mean, he's slightly exaggerated.
Propaganda.
I don't want to get it. I'm happy to discuss it over dinner if you want. I'm happy to discuss it over dinner if you want.
Actually, if anything...
Everyone, just wait a minute. Any serious Holocaust book written post-Goldhagen, post-Hitler's willing executioners, if it doesn't openly reference him to argue with him, it subtly does. Everyone after him is like a breakwater Jewish and Holocaust history, because everyone afterwards is going to have to say something about it. Fine. We go on. There's one more introductory topic, which we'll get to next week. Fine. I'll come at 7 o'clock. Maybe even past 7.